It sort of helps to like dairy products when you start to get hungry in the Netherlands.
There is a cheese market almost every day of the week, somewhere in the north of Holland.
Coming up, we're getting a taste of the culinary treats you can expect to find in Holland, Spain, and France.
The best thing about the menu du jour is that you can guarantee that it's going to be seasonal and it's going to be fresh.
Chef and podcaster Andrew Pryor shares what he's discovered about the French way of eating. Guides from Spain remind us how much their ham can improve any dish.
You can add chopped Iberian ham on top of it.
I mean, I have a lot of friends that are vegetarians. They say, we're vegetarian except for ham.
And for dessert, there's holiday cakes and cookies waiting for us in Norway.
You know, back in the days, if you were a good housewife, you would bake 7 kinds for Christmas.
We're traveling on our stomachs with European food traditions in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Come along. If you're not feeling hungry right now, you probably will by the end of the hour today on Travel with Rick Steves. In a bit, the author of A Food Guide to Paris joins us from his home in the countryside of Western France. That's where Andrew Pryor's been putting the French style of eating into practice every day and leading food tours. Andrew takes us beyond the menu du jour into the ways French people typically enjoy their meals throughout the day so that we might bring a touch of Paris into our own homes as well, wherever we may live. And tour guide friends of mine from Spain tell us how food-themed tours have become all the rage in their country. They'll help us eat our way across Spain. Plus, a guide from Oslo shares memories of the tasty cakes and goodies that he grew up with in Norway, the kinds of desserts that Norwegian bakers are starting to prepare for the holidays right about now. Let's start out the hour grabbing a bite or two in the Netherlands. Our guides, Jody van Engelsdorp and Ellen Janzing, live in Holland, the heart of their country, and the home for all things Dutch that we typically associate with it. Jody and Ellen, if we're going to go and explore Holland, we've got all of this wonderful history, we've got all these amazing dikes and these windmills, we've also got an appetite, and we want to have some good food and something good to drink. What would we look for traveling in Holland to eat and drink very, very Dutch?
A true Dutch person eats cheese and drinks milk. We're all about, those products. And that also goes back to the poldering. The Netherlands has all this swampy land. And so being like swampy land, it was very fertile ground under the sea level, but also wet. So not a lot of crops would grow there, but grass could. So grass equals cows. So we had a lot of good grass, good cows, and now good milk. And the best cheese. I mean, there's a lot of great cheese countries, but we have really good cheese. And if you want to experience that, you can go to the cheese markets. There is a cheese market almost every day of the week, somewhere in the north of Holland. You just go to one of the cute towns, Edam, Volendam, Alkmaar, maybe towards the south, Gouda. And then you can experience all of that Dutch goodness.
And Gouda is the properly pronounced word, what we say, Gouda, right? For Gouda cheese.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. Gouda.
Gouda.
Good.
And you actually drink milk by the glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never met anybody else in Europe that does that.
That's why we're so tall.
And Ellen, when you think of cheese, I would imagine you've got high standards when you're a Dutch
person.
Oh,
yes, of course, yes.
So what is your favorite cheese? What makes good cheese for you?
Old cheese.
Old cheese.
Has to be old to have it like on its own. When you have it on your bread, it can be a bit more, less mature.
Yeah.
But like really old cheese, it's got, even sometimes you can taste the crystals in it, which is like really, so it has a structure to it. And it has a good, deep flavor.
There is a little bit of crunchiness to good old Dutch cheese.
Exactly. It's flaky as well. Yeah. It sort of crumbles.
Well, let's just say you're allergic to milk and cheese. And you're going to be traveling in Holland. What are you going to eat? What else is good?
Herring.
Oh, herring. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gesund.
Mm-hmm.
No, lekker.
Very, very. Lekker en gesund.
Lekker en gesund. That's how they advertise it. You see a little cart selling it. It says it's healthy and it's delicious.
A lot of people are a bit wary of it because it's raw fish, but it's been pickled. So it's
not really raw.
You would not want to eat a raw herring. No, it's not raw. It's like delicate and very soft. And it's fatty fish, so it's very healthy for you.
If you want to impress your friends or freak them out, you say you ate raw herring. If you want them to eat it with you, you say it's pickled herring.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you can get it
eat it different ways and so on. But that's one of the things you'll find in the market. And yes. I just, what I want to, every time, if I think of my favorite towns, I'm thinking of several of them, and they all have beautiful markets if you're there on the right day. Some of them are every day, I think. But it's good to do a little research and find out when's the cheese market, when's the market day, and then be there. That's more important than seeing another church, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
If we went to a market in some beautiful little town without a lot of tourism, what would we find that would be fun?
Oh, I also like stroopwafels.
Stroopwafels, yeah.
Yes. And
stroopwafels are like waffles with syrup that are kind of a sandwich, a syrup sandwich with two little waffles, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, it's one waffle.
One waffle.
And a waffle, it's just they have to slice it. So it's a very thin waffle already. And it takes some, like, talents to slice it right through the middle.
Ah.
And then they put the syrup or the caramel, basically, inside. And then they close it. So it's like,
okay.
Yeah. And it's great, especially warm from the market. It's good.
I don't like an old, hard stroopwafel. I like a warm, new one.
Yeah, fresh ones.
I don't know if I've broken my tooth on anything in my life except for an old, hard stroopwafel.
Oh, no.
Well, when you have an old stroopwafel, you can put it on top of a cup of coffee or tea to soften it up.
Very
But then
nice.
The cookie becomes a bit, so. But the inside becomes softer then.
Well, ideally, go to the market and buy it fresh.
Yes, yes. Do that.
Very nice.
For sure.
Okay, stroopwafel, that's a good thing. What else might we find in the market? Flowers. You know, I've never bought flowers to make my hotel room nicer except in the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
I just love that. You know, it costs you $5 or $10 and you put it in your room and you just feel, aren't I good? I've got a bouquet of Dutch flowers right here in my hotel room.
Very Dutch. We always have flowers in our house.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
It's very good. Yeah. Maybe sometimes you find some Dutch souvenir things like clogs
or like wooden shoes. Yeah.
Sheep. Rugs or, yeah, those kind of things. Yeah.
Okay, but there must be more food than stroopwafels and cheese.
Yeah, pulvertjes.
Okay. Oh, that's another dessert. You got a sweet tooth.
Oh, yes.
those little donuts.
Yeah, they're little small Dutch pancakes.
And bitterballen.
Oh, bitterballen, yeah.
What's bitterballen?
Bitterballen are our favorite savory snack when we have a drink. They're not bitter at all. It's not bitter at all. It used to go with a drink that was called orange bitter. So that's why they have them. But it's like a meat ragu, or now you have vegetarian options as well. And they're just rolled into a ball and then they're breaded and they're deep fried. And you have them with mustard.
That sounds really good.
With your beer. Yeah.
With your beer. Our Dutch tour guide friends are bringing us a taste of Holland right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Ellen Janzing specializes in tour guiding in both the Low Countries and Great Britain and also works as a translator and linguist. Jodie van Engelsdorp guides from her home base in Haarlem in the heart of Holland. We have online links to our guests with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. And one thing I stumbled onto when I was just exploring around in Holland was these little fried bits of fish. I think it was called
kibbeling.
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 Yes.
I felt so excited. I discovered kibbeling. What
it's
is that?
Good,
tell us about kibbeling.
Well, it's a bit like fish and chips that the Brits have, but it's different in that sense that it's smaller pieces.
Yeah.
And it's fresh cod.
Yeah.
And then smaller pieces, just a bit of a, you know, not exactly cut right. It's just a messy bit.
It's a
bit.
Snack that you just feel like you're half seagull when you're eating it.
Yeah, and again, they're sort of in a dough, not particularly breaded like crusty, but in a dough and deep fried. And so they're piping hot.
Yeah.
And then you get a sauce with it, which is like a ravigotte sauce or another type of sauce with sometimes pickles in it. And you have the sauce with it.
So the point is you could find yourself in a market in Hoorn or in Alkmaar or in Edam, and you could have your cheese. You could sample it. You could have the crunchy cheese, which would be older. You could have herring, gezell und lecker, delicious and healthy.
Yes.
You could have your kibbeling, you call it?
Kibbeling,
yes.
Kibbeling. You could have your stroopwafels.
Yeah, and because we have such a big history in colonizing the world, we also always find Indonesian stands and then or another Asian stand where they sell spring rolls. So if you want a fresh spring roll, that's used to be my go-to snack.
A spring roll. And my go-to snack would be, or my go-to meal would be Indonesian in Holland.
Yeah.
I mean, the Dutch colonized Indonesia and you called it the Spice Islands, didn't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because it was all spicy stuff. bring it home.
Yes.
And then you celebrate it with a rice table.
Rice table.
And it's just a pile of rice with all sorts of spicy sides. And yeah. It's a great meal.
Yes, it's perfect.
It's a bit extravagant because the history of it is that the Dutch were in Indonesia and then they would have visitors over and they wanted to present this culture of good food. So they would lay out everything they had, like chicken and pork and rice and noodles and everything. Of course, the Indonesians would never eat it like that. It was just the colonizing people that were doing it like that. And that has evolved in this rice staff, which is an experience in itself because you get so many different dishes all at once.
It's great. And if you don't want to go that extravagant, you can get mini versions of it, bami goreng, nasi goreng, and so on.
Yeah. Very I cook that at home, bami and nasi,
But you could go to the marketplace and put yourself a
small snack,
Or you could just put a whole fancy picnic with all sorts of different Dutch taste treats.
Yeah, and finish with licorice.
Finish with licorice.
Yeah, I think so.
I thought you were going to do another tongue twister.
Drop.
Finish with licorice. Yeah. So licorice is a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. It's very Dutch as well.
Nice.
And we always have like these candy stands as well.
I had licorice at the Open Air Folk Museum in Arnhem.
Oh, nice.
Because they had all these little shops selling old-fashioned candies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love that. You've got Open Air Folk Museums in the Netherlands. There's one in Arnhem and there's one up in the north.
Enkhuizen.
Enkhuizen. Yep. And there you get culture on a lazy Susan. It's all right there.
Yep. Yeah, and Enkhuizen is mainly, because it's in North Holland, is mainly about this lost culture of fishery villages because they created this freshwater lake instead of the Southern Sea. Yeah. And it's all about the Gombe fishery villages and their traditions and their culture.
And there's people that are living this. They're like role-playing. And I just had a wonderful visit up in Enkhuizen. That's the top end of the peninsula above Amsterdam. What a delight. Thank you guys for joining us. Again, we've been talking about the cultural and the natural wonders of Holland as opposed to the Netherlands. And our guides have been Ellen Janzing and Jody van Engelsdorp. Dank u wel.
Alsjeblieft.
Food traditions of France and Spain are just ahead as we stoke our appetites together today on Travel with Rick Steves. Sometimes our listeners send us a haiku poem they've written as souvenirs of their travels. Here's a few we thought you might enjoy.
Krista Sadler from Flagstaff, Arizona, sends us this haiku about the art of good living she found at lunchtime. Square table lunch spread, like artwork, but so tasty. Smoked salmon, divine. Tony Scanio of Irving, Texas, noticed a repeating theme while visiting Sicily. Land of my father, prickly pear are everywhere. Roca Palumba. Teresa Jansen from Port Townsend, Washington, remembers the delights of dinner time in Scandinavia and Germany. Smoked salmon and eel, dark rye bread, brunost and kohl. Raise the vodka. Skål! Plumped sausages lull or steamy taters and kohl. Pour the Riesling. Prost!
A stint on MasterChef Australia convinced Andrew Pryor that he had nothing to lose by moving to Paris. So he signed up for a course at Le Cordon Bleu, where Julia Child got her start some 60 years earlier. Today, Andrew's teaching cooking courses from his home in Montmorillon. It's a city known for making macaron cookies since the 17th century, in a couple hours train ride west of Paris. Andrew's the author of Paris, a fabulous food guide to the world's most delicious city. Andrew Pryor's back with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us how Parisians typically enjoy their day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Andrew, bonjour.
Bonjour, Rick. Merci beaucoup.
What an exciting sort of story you've got. Being from Australia, falling in love with Paris, and moving to France, and now inspiring people to get more out of their travels via the cuisine of the wonderful culture of France. It must be a lot of fun. And how's that going for you in France? Are you settling in? Are you feeling French right now? What's the most gratifying thing in your teaching?
I always feel very French, Rick, but I like to say that I'm the Australian Julia Childs. Look, we're about the same height, I think, but everything else is completely different. But no, definitely, I feel very French. Unfortunately, with my Australian accent, sometimes the French don't understand me, but look, you get by.
Yeah, well, I think it's something that the food would be a sort of a universal language, I'm sure. And when you embrace that and get to know your local providers and your local restaurateurs and your friends at the cafe, you become part of the scene. Hey, our challenge as travelers is to kind of embrace the local tempo of life and become a temporary local when it comes to eating. And what I'd like to do is just spend a few minutes with you talking about the structure of your tasty day in France, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So let's go. As far as breakfast, what in France, not for the tourists, but for locals, is a typical breakfast?
I would say that you typically in France, and especially Paris, if you go to Paris, it's a croissant and coffee, and that's it. They also do a tartine. And so a tartine is basically a baguette that you have butter and jam on. But that is more for the kids would usually have a tartine. For everybody else, it's just a croissant and coffee. And they even dip their croissants in coffee, which I just can't do.
I've seen French people dipping their croissants in coffee. And I don't know, I need protein in the morning. And in my early tours, I used to buy a round of Laughing Cow cheese, and I would just slip everybody a little wedge of that, just that creamy white French cheese, and just so they could put something on their baguette other than butter and jam. But apparently the French people, they go with the sugar and the caffeine, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you know, it sort of makes sense because their main meal, we'll come up to it, but their main meal is in the middle of the day. So, and they're usually having that around about 12 o'clock or, you know, just 12:30, et cetera. So you don't want to fill yourself up too much if you're going to have your main meal right in the middle of the day.
Okay, well that's a very important point to remember if you're feeling like, because in England, the traditional fry was designed to get you through until dinner if you were out in the fields. But in France, they just want to get you by for a couple of hours until you can have a good lunch. And my Parisian friends are appalled if I want to grab a sandwich on the go. For them, that lunch hour is sacred. And, you know, we have these fast lunches for the local office workers. In France, no, you take a little time for lunch, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. So you're going for about 2 hours. And so this is in offices, this is in shops. You'll often find outside of, especially in the French countryside, places just closed from 12 until 2 or 12 until 2:30 even, because everybody's off to lunch. So it's definitely where you have your main meal of the day. You have that entree plate and dessert. You have that at lunch.
Tell us the courses of a lunch, not a tourist lunch, not a quick sandwich on the go, but if you want to sit down like a French person, what would you have?
Yeah, so you would definitely have an entree, main, and dessert. And the entree is usually going to be something light. And that's where these dishes come about. That's just, you know, just a few ingredients, like your, you know, the asparagus with the poached egg. Or, you know, you might even have just a goat's cheese on a toasted baguette or something along those lines. Just really simple entrees. And then you would have a main meal. And depending on the time of the year would depend on what that is. So you might have something a bit more substantial in the winter months and the colder months. And in the summer months, it might be something like a grilled piece of fish or something along those lines. And then the dessert will definitely be, again, a little bit smaller, but it'll still be a sweet treat. And everybody has this, Rick. Even when you go to school, you get an entree, main, and dessert at school.
The entree, that's the appetizer or the first course?
Oh, of course. Sorry, that's my Australianism coming in there.
Because that's confusing to a lot of us, because in some languages, the entree is the main dish, right? So you have a first course, you have a main dish, and a dessert.
In Australia, we do that. We have our entree, main, and dessert, and that gets us into trouble every time we go to the States because we'll ask for an entree, and a rather big meal comes out. So we're always confused. So it's the starter, main, and dessert, yeah.
Starter, and in French, what would the terminology be?
The entree, plat, and dessert. So the main meal is called a plat,
P-L-A-T. Right, there you go. And in French, the menu is... is sort of the meal, not the list of food, right?
Absolutely. So the menu is the menu du jour often. So it'll be the best thing to do when you're going to France and you're going to restaurants.
You could mistakenly ask for the menu, thinking you're going to get the list of food, and you could get the plat du jour.
Absolutely, that's correct. So, you know, you want to be careful, but I will say the best thing about the menu du jour is that you can guarantee that it's going to be seasonal and it's going to be fresh. So it's something that they've gone and usually from a market or something along those lines that they've gone and got and created the meal from there. And a little tip also, one of the best things about the lunch menus everywhere in France and Paris especially is that they have, the French have a thing called the ticket resto system. And so it's a way that they pay for their meals and it's paid for, subsidized by their workplaces. And so this in turn reduces the amount for a menu du jour, usually so that they can track the French people in. So that's where you'll usually find that there's something like a, you know, maybe a $12 or a $13 menu, a 13 euro menu du jour is because they're trying to attract people, the French, with this ticket resto system, their way of paying by these tickets. So we get to benefit from that as well.
The government incentivizes the companies to give their workers this coupon so they can keep the restaurants healthy from a business point of view by stoking their lunch traffic. Is that right?
Yeah, it's definitely. That's exactly what it is. So they get tax subsidies. It's you know, you get a bit of a discount with your tax if you get that money paid to you in these vouchers. And they can even use them to a certain extent when you can when you go shopping at the supermarket. You can buy food with them as well.
Now, in your book, Paris, A Fabulous Food Guide to the World's Most Delicious City, you mentioned that that can cause crowds in the more popular restaurants, and we want to go to the restaurants that are popular with the local workers because they're the best best values, but we should be mindful of when they might be full. What would your advice to be if you're a tourist that's more flexible? Should you come early or late or what?
I would skip breakfast and be there right at 12 o'clock when they open. And but if you can't do that, yeah, go around about at 2 o'clock or 2:30, as long as the place is still open. If there's a place is open 24 hours or the place is open all day, then
in other words, at 1 o'clock, at 1 o'clock they'll be busy with the local workers. And if you're a tourist without the language skills and the local contacts, you might be bullied aside. And if you arrive at noon, life will be much easier for you.
Exactly.
All right. We're eating our way across a great day in Paris with Andrew Pryor on Travel with Rick Steves. Andrew hosts a podcast called Fabulously Delicious, and he's written a book called Paris, A Fabulous Food Guide to the World's Most Delicious City. Okay, so we're talking about lunch, and if I want to find a good area for lunch, I always find that if I go to one of the market areas in a town, it would be surrounded by places that are designed for local shoppers that have a good eye out for a good value, and they also will have access to fresh produce. Do you find that there's good places to eat near the markets, or where would you go for if you're just roaming around town, want a characteristic local place?
Absolutely. You're spot on there. The markets are the perfect place to go. All of those brasseries or bistros or any restaurants that are around that market square, they're always going to have really great food. And that's where I would be attracted to a menu du jour for sure from there. It was Patricia Wells, I think, wrote about it and once said that if she sees that there's a bag of potatoes out the front of a restaurant, that she knows that they make their own chips. And so you don't need to do that nowadays. You can just check. Most restaurants will have fate maison written on it, and that means that everything's made in-house. And also a lot of restaurants now and bistros, et cetera, they'll actually put where the ingredients are from. So, you know, that the beef was French beef, and
that's
not just
great.
That it was French beef, but the actual area it's from as well.
So fate maison, F-A-I-T-M-A-I-S-O-N, oui. Fate maison. That means made on the premise.
Made on the premises. And that's, for me, I'm a bit of a dessert lover, so I'm always looking for a dessert that's made on premises.
Well, there you go. Spoken like a true Aussie, I think. Hey, now it's time for dinner. For me, that's the, I know it's, French people like to take their time at lunch, but I'm out there sightseeing at lunch, so I'm going to have myself a more of an involved dinner. We've got the courses. Clarify for me, the menu would be the fixed menu, not the piece of paper that lists the food. And the menu in French is called la carte, right?
That's right. So la carte will be the one that, it depends on the restaurant, whether it will be that it'll just be, you know, a set list, or whether that restaurant You do see a lot more in France and especially in Paris, restaurants just having the fixed menu. But it's not sort of the fixed menu that I know as an Australian. When we go to restaurants in Australia and it's a fixed menu, there's a, you know, it might be like a degustation meal or a tasting meal. These are just fixed menus because of the wanting, you know, to get the best ingredients and just offering a certain amount of dishes. Because really in France, that's what the restaurants are known for. They were sort of like Japan in that way, that you can find many places that just serve just a few things, but really well. And that's one of the things that I love.
I think that's the mark of a good restaurant. And I used to think the, you know, the daily specials was just stuff on the push list. But no, that's what the chef wants you to have because it's seasonal.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's nothing better than doing that. There's nothing better than going to a supermarket, even here in France, and it's not summer, it's winter, and there's no tomatoes. That's when you know it's a good supermarket, because they're not catering for everybody.
Right.
They're just
right.
saying this isn't in season.
Or in the market, it'll say where it's from. And if it had to be imported, that might be a negative compared to if it was grown locally. And astute shoppers will consider that before they buy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I will say one of the things that you might want to do before dinner, even though dinner is very, very important, is the French version of afternoon tea, which is the goûter. So it's spelled G-O-U-T-E-R, but of course you don't pronounce the R on the end. And the French get taught this from school, you know, when they're kids, they'll have a goûter. So it's, you know, a little snack to get them over until they have dinner at 8 o'clock. But of course, nice. I mean, you know, I'm still a kid at heart, so I have to have my goûter every day as well.
We're eating our way through a great day in Paris right now with Australian Francophile and food enthusiast Andrew Pryor. Hey, Andrew, there's a few points I'd like to clarify in our last couple of minutes here on dinner. First of all, I'm interested in an experience. And if I'm not going to order the tasting menu, which is a lot of fun if you really want to spend a little more money and enjoy the best of the kitchen, I like to arrange with my travel partners to share our dishes, ask for a small extra plate. Is that considered crude in a restaurant? Or if people are polite and so on, does the wait staff accommodate you?
Oh, absolutely. The wait staff would accommodate you. No, that's definitely something that you would be able to do. Mm-hmm. And we do this often, especially when you have things like that are really easily shared around. For example, moule frites, just ask for the moule. You know, you don't get the frites and then just have that at the center of the table.
So this is something that a lot of American travelers are very self-conscious about. And I would just remind people, we are there for the experience. You can max out the experience while saving money and not having to overeat by eating family style. And it's okay in a nice French restaurant to do that. Andrew, one of the highlights for me when I'm traveling is the cheese course, because I just love cheese. What's your advice for a cheese course when dining out for dinner in France?
I would absolutely go for a cheese course, and I would have that instead of dessert. For me, the best advice, it's sort of, you know, you would ask us to see the sommelier for the wine. So I would just ask the waiter and the chef to bring out what they think are the best cheeses, because they're usually French and the French know what it's like to have good cheese. So I would ask them to bring out what they think is the best, and I would have that instead of dessert.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Andrew Pryor about eating smartly and memorably on our next trip to France. Andrew's book is called Paris, a fabulous food guide to the world's most delicious city. And Andrew, I'd like to just finish off our conversation right now with a comment about the liqueurs that you might have before and after dinner. It's a way to extend the dining experience. And a lot of us travelers don't really understand the ritual. What's your advice for a drink when you sit down and a drink after you're done?
So I would say for a drink when you sit down, definitely go for the apéritif. So the apéritif beforehand. So you might want to try something like a Kir or a Pinot Charente, which are designed for that, you know, to have before your meal. But definitely you want to have a digestive after the meal. It is going to soothe your stomach and it's going to make you have a really lovely night's sleep.
So it's a practical thing. The aperitif prepares your appetite, I think literally, and the digestif helps you digest it afterwards. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's what it's meant to be there for. And, you know, after having such a rich meal, if you have a rich meal, then you want to have that, you know, might be a sip of cognac or Armagnac or something after the meal, and that will just totally just settle your stomach down.
God, those French, they think of everything when it comes to enjoying a good meal. Andrew Pryor, thanks so much for your work, and thanks for joining us, and bon appétit.
Rick, merci beaucoup. Bon app.
Andrew's website is andrewpryorfabulously.com. Let's eat our way across Spain in a moment. And for dessert, we'll have a sweet little chat about what they're baking for the holidays in Norway. First, here's something I learned a few years ago about the food scene in England. There are lots of tired old jokes about British cuisine. But the truth is, England has a livelier food scene than ever. And much of it relates to Britain's colonial heritage. A legacy of the empire upon which the sun never set? You can taste it in the variety of chutneys. Originally from India, chutney is a staple condiment in England. On a recent visit to York, I enjoyed a lesson from my tour guide, Tom Wright. He explained to me how chutney is freedom in a jar.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I've been in England for about 24 hours, and I'm with my friend Tom Wright.
Hello there.
Tom's a student here, a history student.
I am indeed, I am.
He is my guide, and we're just having a quick bite to eat in a cool restaurant, and we're eating this plate. This is a lunch plate for two, and I was just commenting on the chutney, and I was asking Tom, what do you do with chutney? Is it like mustard? Do you put it on bread? Is it measured for the different ingredients or whatever? And Tom was telling me a little bit about chutneys.
Well, absolutely. You've got to try and make sure you get the right chutney for the right cheese. Chutney can be made out of all sorts of things, different vegetables, different fruits. It can be spicy, it can be sweet, it can be bitter.
Now, this one is a little bit spicy, isn't it?
It's
peppery.
It's delicious.
And it's not sweet, it's just, it's right. And you get a whole line of them in the grocery store.
Oh, absolutely. You go to the better shops and you can find half an aisle dedicated to different types of chutney. You've got to get the right one to go with the right meats. If you go and buy a chutney in a shop, spend a good 5 or 10 minutes, because the right one will complement it perfectly.
So now, do you put chutney on something or on the side, or do you use it like mustard on the bread?
Up to you. You can put it anywhere. You can put it on the side. You can put it on your piece of meat or cheese. You can spread it on your bread. Do anything you like.
It's freedom.
Freedom. Freedom in a jar.
Freedom in a jar. That's chutney, and this is traveling in England. Happy travels. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. You gotta eat when you're on the road, so why not design your travels around sampling and learning about the food specialties of a country you're visiting? Two of my favorite guides from Spain join us now on Travel with Rick Steves to help us eat our way across their gastronomically rich country, and to suggest what not to miss if we're designing a food-themed trip of our own. Jorge Roman is on the line from his home in Madrid, and Francisco Glaria joins us from northeastern Spain at his home base in Pamplona. Hola, amigos.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you for hosting us.
Hey, you guys, have you noticed how popular food tours are lately for travelers to Spain?
Absolutely. It's one of the top requirements now for groups, especially families or friends groups, that they just want to melt into the gastronomy, which is one of the big things about this country.
And it helps to have somebody who knows the words and knows the cuisine and knows the people who run the little restaurants and the little bars and so on, so you can come along. So let's just put together a food tour right now. I'd love it if you guys could tell me, if you were putting together a food tour, what are the iconic taste treats that you would include on the tour? Francisco, what would you have for sure?
I would always have tortilla de patatas, which is a Spanish omelette.
Is that the tortilla español?
Tortilla española, there we go.
Okay, and then what else?
I would have gazpacho.
Gazpacho, okay. And Jorge, what would you have?
Well, I cannot compete with the tortilla española, but I do compete with Francisco's tortilla española, because Francisco's one is without onion. Mine has to be with onion. So there is a national debate there.
Okay, so the Basque versus the rest of Spain.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about each of these a little bit later, but I just want to get the list going now. What's something you would add to the list?
Octopus.
Octopus. Interesting.
Yeah. Octopus.
All right, and what's another one?
I would say salmorejo, which is very similar to, but very different at the same time, to gazpacho.
Now, I would say we need to have jamón, because that's just sort of like the national meat of Spain.
Yeah.
And you've got to appreciate the good jamón.
And paella.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking something very new and interesting and confusing to me is tostada con tomate.
Yes, that's very Catalonian. That's very, very Spanish. Bread with tomato.
And then I'd like to finish it off with churros and sangria. How's that?
Sounds perfect to me.
Okay, this is good. So now those are our stops. Now we're going to be, you guys are going to take the town of your dreams and you're going to meet me and my buddies and we're going to go stopping at the first place. And I'm just going to put all these little spots out and you're going to explain it to us. Because as tourists, we're confused about the tostada con tomate, the toasted bread with tomatoes rubbed on it, right? Jorge, what's the deal with that? How can we appreciate that?
Well, you couldn't have said it better. It's just a piece of toast. Could be half a baguette or just a typical slice of bread. You toast it and then you just get a tomato. And the tomato has to be a little bit tender, okay? So that's why you just wrap the tomato on top. If you wanted a different version, just before the tomato, wrap a garlic.
Europeans love to rub things on toast, I've found.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you're going to actually take your toast, you're going to rub the garlic on it, and then you're going to squish a tomato on it, literally, and it becomes soggy bread soaked in the garlic and the tomato.
Adding a few drops of extra virgin olive oil.
Perfect. Okay, so that's what we're going to try.
Yeah.
And let's say we're going to have some cold vegetable soup. And you would explain the difference between gazpacho and salmorejo. How would you do that?
That's correct. Well, salmorejo is very simple. It's just five ingredients and doesn't have pepper and doesn't have water, less vinegar, etc. And it's thicker. And it's also a summer soup. You eat it cold. And also, it has one of your favorite things, Rick, when you're in Spain. You can add chopped Iberian ham on top of it.
Ooh, so you do. I remember that with my gazpacho or my, I guess, salmorejo.
Salmorejo
is almost like solid gazpacho.
Yeah, perfect. That's the perfect definition, solid gazpacho.
And you have a spoon of garnishes, and one of them would be little bacon bits, essentially.
Serrano ham,
A lot of tourists are sort of wigged out by cold vegetable soup, but it's so refreshing. It's so right for the climate. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Jorge Roman and Francisco Glaria. They're our guides right now in Spain. Francisco's website is travelingsteps.es, and Jorge's website is travelingwithjorge.wordpress.com. And Jorge is spelled J-O-R-G-E. Now, Francisco, we're going to go to another bar. We're going to walk across town, step into the bar. All above us is a forest of ham hocks with little upside-down umbrellas. It's just like this would be a hellish experience for a vegetarian, but we're going to be carnivorous. We're going to go in there, and we're going to gain an appreciation of jamón. Francisco, what is the lesson we'd have?
So jamón, everywhere around Spain, we do have amazing jamón. We put this little cone on the bottom of the leg so the fat doesn't drip into the people. And the thing is that ham, it's, I mean, I have a lot of friends that are vegetarians. They say, we're vegetarian except for ham. Because ham, it's an amazing delicacy in Spain. I mean, it's like beyond good.
I got to say, it's a ritual for me. When I come to Spain, you guys, it's a ritual. I have to have my, it's not jamón, it's jamón.
Jamón.
Very important. And I want to pay top dollar for it. I don't want to be budget traveler when it comes to ham. Life is too short to have cheap ham.
Yes.
It's expensive.
You're going to eat a lot. So you eat a little bit, pay for it, and it's going to be incredible.
That's good. Now, what you might want to have for a less expensive accompaniment, Francisco, would be the tortilla espanol. And this is, for me, just kind of a go-to at breakfast or whatever. If you want something substantial and very local and always there, tell us about the tortilla espanol.
So when people think about tortilla, they think about Mexican tortilla, you know, the flatbread. Here, for us, a tortilla is an omelette, okay? So it's egg, potato, and onions. That's all it is, okay? So it's basic, it's good. I would say it's comfort food for Spain. I mean, when you have Spanish people, what do you want to eat? What do you miss from your grandma? Tortilla española, okay? That's what we eat. In every single bar, you're going to find tortilla española in Spain.
And if you want just a very simple little meal, you just go get a little, just like a slice of pizza or a slice of pie. It's about 2 inches tall, and it's a delightful, quick bite. It's very cheap. Wash it down with whatever you like to drink, and you're on your way. Jorge, what makes a good tortilla espanol for you? Because you can have a bad tortilla espanol.
Yeah, I mean, it's so simple to make it that you have to be a really bad cook or chef to spoil it. So it's just simmer the potatoes in chunks, in oil, and then just simmer them. And when they are tender, just put them in scrambled eggs and just play by the eye, okay? The trick is just to turn it over. That is
turn it over. That's all the thing.
But I know several places that they're very famous in Spain because 6-inch tall tortilla. Six inches tall.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, the inventors of the tortilla española, they were the Basques. So Francisco
no
knows
Francisco
a lot about that. Yeah.
Now I want to drop into a bar that's famous for its seafood, and it's either going to be prawns cooked in garlic or octopus. Francisco, that seems like a northwestern Spain thing. Tell us about prawns cooked in garlic versus octopus.
So gambas al ajillo, prawns with garlic, it's one of the things, especially in the north of Spain, we eat them big time. I mean, it's like there are many, many places around by the coast that you can find them. Octopus in Spain, we eat a lot. We love it. You have it grilled, you have it boiled, you have it in many different ways. People just need to take out the image of an octopus with all those legs. It's just one of those foods that you need to just trust your waiter. It's going to be good. Don't think what you're
eating. Here's my image. I like it in the elements. I was at a great market in Santiago, and the guy in the market, he had a big pot with all the octopuses boiling in it, and he pulled it up, and it was this eight-legged dream come true if you're hungry. And he put it on a big wooden platter and bump, 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 cut it up just like rapid fire into little toothpick-sized chunks, gave it to me on a tiny wooden platter with some nice sauce on it, right fresh. It was hard to imagine a tastier plate of seafood.
It's delicious, really incredible.
What is it, pulpo? What is the word?
Pulpo. That's how we say octopus.
Pulpo. And while we're talking seafood, let's pretend, I guess it's down in the south where we'd find more of this, but paella. Jorge, when I'm in a bar and the man comes out with a platter of freshly cooked paella, everybody stops what they're doing and grabs a little tapa of that just to try it.
True.
How would you introduce paella to your group on this food tour?
Okay, first of all, I always tell my people that I will put them in the black book if I learn that they put chorizo in the paella. Chorizo and paella, that's not much at all. And there's a special rice in Spain, which is very similar to the arborio in Italy, what we call it bomba, B-O-M-B-A. And the secret to have a good paella in a place is that you have to read in the menu that it needs 20 minutes, a minimum per two people. So if you get a little tapa of paella that the bar, restaurant, tavern, however you want to call it, just came out with, many people know that the paellas are taken out from the kitchen from 1 up until 1:30, sometime in between. That's the time frame. So if you get there at that time, you will eat it fresh. That's the key. The moment you get there a little bit later, the rice gets soaky and mushy.
Yes, I know, because the paella that most tourists will judge paella on is old paella, mm-hmm. where it's all soggy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the good paella is that spontaneous delight that comes out of the kitchen. And I don't care what you're eating, I don't care what you're doing, if a man or a woman walks by with a platter of 15 little plates of paella, grab one of those.
Yeah,
and it'll be so fresh, it'll be la paella like you've never had before. Our guides to the culinary variety of Spain are Francisco Glaria and Jorge Roman. Francisco lives in Pamplona. Jorge is based in the capital, Madrid. They both lead American visitors across various itineraries in Spain, and they host the Spanish Loops podcast. You can learn more about the Spanish tradition of fancy appetizers called tapas in an interview from our Travel with Rick Steves archives. You'll find a shortcut to that with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Okay, so we're just going to finish up our food tour now. And I guess, first of all, we got to make sure we have a good drink. Francisco, what drink would you make sure people appreciate on your food tour?
When you go to Spain, you have to try sangria. I mean, we do have amazing wines, but sangria, it's the mother of all wines in Spain. It's refreshing, it's easy to drink, it's fun, and unfortunately, a lot of bars, they're beginning to overprice it, but it's so good.
Okay, so we're going to have sangria, and now it's time for dessert. And Jorge, you've taken me into bars in Madrid for the churros con chocolate.
Oh, of course.
Tell us about churros and why we want to cap our meal with that, with some nice pudding-like hot chocolate.
Well, you just described this like hot pudding that if you put the churro inside of it, it almost stands up because it's so thick.
Now, the churro is a very, like a greasy cigar-shaped donut, right?
Actually, you have two shapes. It's what you said, the cigar shape, and then you have the teardrop shape. And the dough is exactly the same. So you have the two options. Both is exactly the same recipe. And it depends if they are kids. Probably, you know, it's much easier for them to get the little ones and dip it into the chocolate.
And if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you've been drinking all night and you're exhausted and staggering and you're just ready to put a nail in the coffin, you drop by the churros place and have
and you get and
pudding.
You get a boost, and then you go again for another drink somewhere else.
So I've heard. That's long after my bedtime, but I'll tell you, this has been a great food tour. And if our listeners, when they put their travel dreams together, if they can imagine stopping into a characteristic town in Spain, having a wonderful guide like you guys, and putting those 8 stops together, that would be a beautiful, tasty, unforgettable and educational experience. Mm-hmm. Jorge and Francisco, let's wrap it up by just, I want you guys to title this food tour. What would you call the food tour, Jorge? And then I'll ask Francisco, what would you name this food tour?
Eat like a Spaniard.
Eat like a Spaniard. That's great. And Francisco, what would you call the food tour?
A country with many cultures makes a country with very good food.
Wow. I thought you were going to give me something silly and trite, but that is profound.
Yeah.
A country with many cultures is a country with what?
With good food.
With good food. Francisco Glaria, Jorge Roman. How do I say buen provecho, right?
Buen provecho.
Buen apetito, buen provecho, yes.
And happy travels. Thank you guys so much for sharing your expertise on Spain and its food with all of us.
Thank you, Rick, for having us.
You'll find web links to our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. What's for dessert? Let's check in with Paul Johansen in Oslo now for a nice piece of cake. It's quite a tradition in Norway, especially with the holidays coming up.
Paul, when I think of Norway, I've got Norwegian relatives, and it is holiday cakes. Whenever you get together, it seems like there's a festival waiting to happen, and every grandma cooks up her favorite cakes, and there's a lot of traditional cakes. If you think through the holiday year, what are some of the, as a child, looking forward to some sort of a festive treat?
Well, I think especially during Christmas, when you have the julekake.
Julekake.
Which is a Christmas cake.
How do you describe that?
It kind of looks more like a bread in a way.
Yeah. And is it a fruit bread kind of?
Kind of. It has raisins
fruit cake,
in it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you will cut it up as a bread.
Uh-huh.
And you can put some butter on it.
Yeah.
And then some brown cheese, some goat cheese.
I love the goat cheese.
And that's good stuff.
That's a nice thing.
That's the good stuff.
There's a cake that is a bunch of circles that get smaller and smaller, and it is just covered with Norwegian flags.
Mm-hmm. That's kransekake.
Kransekake.
Uh-huh. And that's very typical for our national day, the 17th of May.
Okay, so on...
And also for Christmas as well.
Okay, and Norwegian Independence Day and Christmas, you get the kransekake.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And that's one of my favorites, actually.
My memory was having kransekake for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was filming in Norway for our Christmas special, I asked for a julekake, because I know jule means Christmas, and I just assumed we'd get the one with the rings on it. And they got me the loaf of fruitcake. And I said, no, I wanted the julekake. But no, that was the julekake. And I was thinking kransekake. That's a very nice treat. And there's something called Napoleon's cake, Napoleon kaka.
There is, which is impossible to eat. Because they got like 2 hard layers on the bottom and the top and then a lot of cream in the middle.
Yeah, so I remember as a child, even it would just be a mess because I would try to cut through the top layer and it's just...
But it's good. It's really good. And then we have blötkake.
What is that?
Translates to soft cake.
soft cake.
Which is like sugar buns, and then you have a lot of whipped cream and
there's whipped
strawberry.
Cream. I think that's the go-to sweet is just put the whipped cream in.
Yeah, it is. A lot of whipped cream.
Krumkaka.
Krumkaka.
That's my favorite. Now, when people put whipped cream in krumkaka, to me that's the, we say, gilding the lily. It's,
okay.
It's good enough already. You don't need to make it
you
fancier.
You do that here in the U.S.? You put.
I think it's a travesty. I just like the krumkaka straight.
Yeah, so do we in Norway. We normally eat it straight.
That's good.
Yeah, very typical Christmas cake. Yeah.
Is that for Christmas also?
Yeah, it is.
Krumkaka. And that's one of the ways here in the United States, I think a lot of Norwegian families send their traditions from one generation to the next is grandma's going to teach you how to give you a krumkaka iron.
Yeah, krumkaka iron.
Oh, yeah. That's a very important thing. What else is there? There's fatiman.
Fatiman, yeah.
Describe that.
Ooh,
Powdered sugar.
It's quite dry.
Yeah, it is dry.
It's like a small cookie in a way.
Yeah, it's like eating a dust ball covered with powdered sugar.
Kind of, yeah. You know, back in the days, if you were a good housewife, you would bake 7 kinds for Christmas.
A fatiman.
Yeah, fatiman was one of those
is that right?
7 kinds, yeah. And you would have to bake them in December so they would be ready for Christmas.
And it seems to me there's always coffee.
Always coffee. Actually, Norwegians are the biggest coffee drinkers in the world. I think Norway and Finland this year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because there's a tradition of having your coffee and your cinnamon bun in the morning, I think.
Yeah, coffee and something sweet. And,
In Sweden, they even have a word for that, a fika.
Yeah, it's a fika, yeah.
Same thing in Norway?
We just call it a coffee break. Yeah.
Paul, thanks so much. I should say tusen takk.
Tusen takk.
And I'll see you next time in Oslo.
Yep.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Thanks to Gretchen Strock for reading our listener travel haiku. Send us what you've written about your travel impressions. There's a link at ricksteves.com/radio.
My Facebook friends are a fun community of curious travelers, and you're invited to join in. To stow away with me in my work, play, politics, philanthropy, and travels, follow me at Rick Steves on Facebook.